Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Erica Vail, you come to the Autism Roundtable with so much to offer. Tell us a little bit about your personal and professional background in relationship to the autism world.
Well, thank you so much for having me. So for autism, I've been a special education teacher for 12 years before opening up my business. And I worked with students with the autism spectrum, from inclusion, resource room. I did self-contained as well, which was the LLD setting, learning language disabilities. And I also co-taught with the autism and behavioral disabilities classes as well. So that's my professional experience in regards to working with students with autism. And then also aside from that, I also family members with autism, and in general doing martial arts has also been when I worked with populations of students that had autism, among other disabilities, both physical and intellectual.
So on your journey of working with special education, which pieces touched you and what inspired you to go ahead and open up your own business? And tell us a little bit about that journey.
So I always knew getting into education, I always wanted to open up my own business, whether that be more tutoring based or advocacy and consulting based. I always love helping people since I've been on a young age. It's always been just a natural instinct of mine, and I just love being able to help others. And working as a special education teacher, you know, I've been able to work with so many wonderful families, and seeing those small milestones be such huge accomplishments. So definitely, you know, it was so enlightening to see the families, you know, be able to watch their child that maybe might not have been able to speak before, and now seeing them have their first words. That was such a wonderful journey to be part of. So being an advocate and educational consultant was always like my passion. And I came from having dyslexia, being diagnosed in third grade. So I learned at a young age to be an advocate for myself. And I learned from my parents as well as, you know, positive educators. That was not, unfortunately, always the case that I always had a great influence and a teacher. But I do have the handful that was a wonderful influence, in my educational journey, that I actually, you know, still connect with today. I actually had my second grade teacher reach out to me for another student. And she's like, oh, I know someone who opened up their own business. She'll be perfect for you. She's an advocate, educational consultant. So it was wonderful just having like my second grade teacher from all those years ago, just still being able to plug and support me, throughout my journey. But Primarily my parents and my sister have always been my biggest cheerleaders throughout my entire life.
Wow. And in the education setting, what would you say highlights a teacher as someone that could be impactful to someone that's struggling?
Yes. So teaching, you have to meet a large population. I think the way that the public school system in particular is set up is we meet the mean, we meet the average. So whether you're on both different ends of the spectrum, needing more help or needing more challenges, being more of that a gifted or talented label, sometimes those outliers are not what's always targeted and it's missed. So I never want those to fall through the cracks in our education system, which is why I always encourage parents to be their own advocate. But the teachers who really, you know, meant something to me were ones that went out of their way to make sure I was feeling comfortable in the classroom setting, making sure I was achieving my goals, and also went out of their way to highlight the positives in what I was doing. So even though at a younger age, I wasn't the strongest reader and I was always nervous when it was called time to be read upon, the teachers who understood that versus pushed through that nerves and anxiety, and understanding that because I had dyslexia, that was going to be something that was going to be very nerve-wracking for me to read in front of everybody else in the classroom. So those teachers who didn't push that boundary, but those who understood it and accepted it, those are the ones that really stuck with me.
Amazing. And as a parent myself with children that struggle, at times, every child is their own individual and each one has their own package of different needs. As a younger parent, I think I was scared to reach out to teachers and let them know what my child's background is. And at this point,
I know their needs from seeing what works and didn't work. And as a parent, I find it very influential and helpful to my children when I reach out to a teacher and tell them, you know, my child does really well when you don't call on her to read, or when you give her positive feedback when she's struggling, or go over to her after and give her that positive feedback that you thought she did a great job. And I think as parents, we are advocates, and we do have to sort of reach out and take that step for our children and tap into the teachers and give them those components. What has your experience been with reaching out to teachers, and what have you seen to work best in helping guide children that are struggling?
Yes, I think from both ends of the spectrum with my, and you know, educational and advocate consultant hat on, and also being a teacher, you see the parents who always, you know, inundate and flood your emails with every little thing. But then you also have the parents who don't reach out enough. And sometimes when the parents don't reach out enough, I always want to make that effort to reach out to them, because I don't know if maybe they're comfortable. I don't know if they maybe want to share, but they don't want to seem like they're being pushy, or if they don't want to be appeared as annoying to a teacher. And so I always want to take that extra step to connect with them. But reaching out with teachers, having that collaboration, I really pride myself on building that home and school gap. Because if what's working at home and we're not seeing it at school, how can we see it at school? Or same thing, if we're seeing a child, you know, do a skill at school, but we're not seeing it in the home environment, how do we bridge that gap? How do we generalize that skill? And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is through collaboration.
Amazing. And in your experience, you know, you have PTAs or parent conferences. So you have those built in, or phone calls. My school, I think the teachers call every quarter or something to just touch base. But when would you say it is too much for a parent to reach out, versus when do you think a parent should actually reach out?
I go by a rule of thumb. So if a parent is asking for meetings every single week, if they're asking even every month, and then I'm saying, well, we don't have enough data or enough information at that time, so let's give the teacher maybe 2 months of information. Because thinking if there's breaks in between, if we only have 5 days, we don't have 7 days of the week that we're getting that information, we want to factor that in, and also want to be able to see where that growth is. If it's in regards to behavior, I usually recommend seeing, okay, if we're trying a new skill or a new behavior plan, let's see what happens in 2 weeks. And then if something's not working, we can address it then. But I want to make sure things are being followed through with fidelity and validity. That's the only way to know if it is or is not working. So we started a token economy system. We want to see if that's working. It only works if the token economy system is being utilized effectively and daily and regularly with consistency. A lot of times I think that parents want to know every little detail, which they have every right to know that those details involves their child. So I also think there's that balance of having that understanding with a teacher or staff, whoever's working with them, whether it be related services like OT, PT, speech, understand that this is that parent's child. It's their world. So they want to understand what's going on. And I really hone in on the factor when we have communication that is limited, how would you feel if you got to go home but you couldn't articulate how your day was? So to put yourself in their shoes to understand why a parent might be over asking and what may be their dynamic is to be more accepting to that.
I always tell parents, you know, as an occupational therapist, when parents will touch base with me, I always say more is better. Reach out. I'm so happy to hear. I'm so happy to interact. You don't want to be that annoying parent that's calling every single session. That's not appropriate. But definitely, you know, twice a month to have a touch base is, you know, that doesn't last for an hour. It could really last for 5 minutes. And you could hear like, what is going on in that therapy session? What is going on at school? What is going on? Just for 5 minutes, just fill me in so that then I can carry it over. So that is super duper important.
I used to have a parent just send me like a quick like emoji of like how the morning was, though I knew what was entering the door like in my classroom that morning. Like, oh, okay, we had a heart. We had a great day. We had that little like sideways smiley face. Oh, okay. Better be a little bit leery. Step on eggshells a little bit so we get used to our day routine. Which is always helpful for me as well as when they go home. I'm probably an over-communicator myself in regards to, I'm very detail-oriented, so I like to know every little thing. If a child comes home and says something, I want the parent to know what was the circumstances. so that way they can navigate the conversation versus walking in blind to it.
Wow, that's amazing. And I've also created within my therapy sessions like a communication notebook where I could write down, like, even while I'm still treating the child, I'll take out my notebook and I'll just write what I did, you know, shorthand that day so that the parent feels communicated with. And as a parent, if that's not happening and you're not getting feedback from therapists or you're not getting feedback from teachers, advocating for yourself is important and saying, hey, could we start a communication notebook, or what other communication systems have you seen to work that weren't like high labor intensive for the teacher?
So for some of my, you know, private clients, I've made communication logs via Google Docs. So it's something for the, you know, teachers to fill in on a biweekly or monthly basis. So it's all in one spot. Communication notebooks have been wonderful as well. Communication sheets, where it's like a quick little circle, like reference, but it's tailored to the child. There's so many wonderful things on like Teachers Pay Teachers or, you know, it's different websites, but it doesn't tailor it to the child unless you can edit it. So I want to make sure, like, if a child's toilet training, that's in that sheet. And let's make sure that we can communicate that with the family. But I think for me, like, anything, email is great, but I also think it gets lost in the thread. So I creating some type of digital document. Everything's in one place, so the school has it, but also the family has it. Especially if it were to go anywhere else in regards to, like, legal terms, then at least it's all in one location. And I think that it keeps everything organized and consistent for the family.
Amazing. Amazing. I love that idea. Okay, so you were inspired to open your own consulting business or a school consultant, advocate. Tell us a little bit about what inspired that, what services you offer, and why would a parent reach out to a advocate or a consultant? Paint us a little bit of a picture of why that would be.
So I launched my business in January of 2025, and I resigned from teaching in December of 2024. So I always knew that this was what I wanted to do. And I think since having my daughter, who gave me that leap of faith, that jump, that I'm like, you know what, mom can do this. I can open up my own business, which has been on my mind for years. But obviously gaining that experience, it's priceless. You can't, you know, put a dollar on what you have in experience. And to help families, that's always been my passion in teaching, to support the family side and the student side of things. So with that, I opened up Vail Advocacy and Consulting. It's an LLC, and we do educational advocacy. We do consulting for school districts as well as colleges, universities, so students who are in the education field. I've done lectures at TCNJ for a class to try to promote, you know, what we do, what education is, kind of the Q&A for future educators as well. In addition, I do review 504s, I review IEPs, I draft IEP goals and objectives to support in that collaboration process with the school district, conduct observations both home and school, also during extracurricular activities as well, if a parent so wishes to have an observation done during those settings too, especially with that social piece. That's where I usually see that request be made. I do parent coaching, executive functioning. How do we implement these IEP goals in a natural setting? So I don't want to make anything more work or add something to both more of a plate of a teacher or more of the plate of a parent. So how can we embed it in your natural life? So a lot of my parent coaching is tailored to the families. And then I offer private tutoring and success management, which is both for general education students and special education students, because time is precious. So how can we help all families communicate with their teachers effectively and bridge that homeschool gap? So making resources, materials for families to help students achieve their individual goals.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. You've really covered the gambit.
Yes, thank you. Yes, no, it's a big passion of mine. So, and I love being part of all the IEP meetings. I like to be viewed as a collaborative member. I think sometimes hearing an advocate's coming, it's like, oh no, like a shark's coming to, you know, like someone else is coming out there. And it's not my personality. But if we need to take measures in a different way, then there are other avenues for that. But I like to take a very collaborative, professional approach and very data-driven approach. If the numbers aren't speaking to it, then how can we collect the data so that way it can represent what we feel is a need? I think that's really important for families because your emotions are so high and invested. It's your child, it's your baby. And sometimes families even say, I'm going to let my advocate speak because I'm too emotionally like high or invested at the moment. And sometimes that hinders the positive flow of communication between parent and school. So I think that also playing that middle person has been also very important for families, especially when it's been a very taxing or long process. I honestly feel everyone can benefit from having an advocate or educational consultant. I think that my use the saying a lot that if you're given a manual of, for me, fixing a car, I wouldn't know where to start. Is the parents are given the PRISE manual, which is the parental rights and special education. Where do I start? And it has all the answers in there, but how do I actually read it? How do I navigate it? So I do think that having someone who's in the career, who is an actual identified advocate or consultant help you with that journey was very beneficial.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's almost like when you go into something new and it's sort of, you know, overwhelming. Like, where am I supposed to go first? What am I supposed to do second? You know, when we're navigating anything brand new, it's always nice to have somebody who's already navigated it and able to sort of, you know, show us the way. I know a lot of parents that work with me, you know, prior to going into like a school meeting, especially their first, it's like, whoa, what am I supposed to do? How do you prepare parents for that first meeting?
So especially initials, they're so overwhelming. There's a lot of faces at the table. I always encourage a parent to go with somebody. So if they haven't had it, don't hire an advocate or educational consultant to go with them. You know, have a friend, have a relative, have your partner go with you to those meetings. I also encourage recording of those meetings. Not for a I got you moment. It's more for there's a lot of information that there needs to be digest. So let's have it on recording so I can replay it and digest it when my brain's not going in a million different directions because I have all of these professional speaking jargon that I don't know. There's times even too where it's helpful for me at a meeting, like, oh, share the recording with me. Let me listen to it because there was a part in there that I want to do more research on. Maybe I wasn't as familiar with it. And I'm very humbled to tell a client, like, let me find this answer out for you if I don't know it. And also having that openness and conversation with the families is very important to a successful outcome. But preparing them for there is going to be a lot of people. There is going to be a lot of jargon. Do not feel pressured to sign anything at these meetings, especially if an IEP is suggested or proposed because they found them eligible for services. Take that time to review it and answer questions. It's a lengthy document. So I never want a family to feel pressured to sign in those moments. And if you have questions, then ask them or ask them at a later date in an email. So that way you have it all in one, you know, location to access later on. But I always tell families, take a deep breath. You know, they're going to speak, you know, relative. Hopefully they gave you the documents in advance. Each state has their different policies and regulations. Like for New Jersey, you want to get them like 10 days in advance prior to your meeting. So you have that opportune time to review it. But you can even, you know, request that no matter what location you're in. But the timeline might differ depending upon what state you're in. And being able to review the reports, depending upon what was assessed, that's also helps, I think, calm nerves for families as well, because they already have prior knowledge of what's going to be shared with them.
Who's usually at that initial meeting? Who would parents, you know, be ready to meet? And I love that piece that you said that there are documents that you could look at prior and make sure that you have, because I always feel that when I come prepared to meetings or I come with knowledge prior, that's very empowering to me, because then I'm not like, oh dear, in the headlights, what's next? It's all happening to me. I would rather be in a position where I'm prepared and I'm ready to observe and take in the information. And I think being prepared is a huge component of that.
Oh yeah. It's never a good feeling to feel like you're a deer in headlights, you know, in a meeting at all. So for reports, depending upon what they were looking for in regards to a child study team evaluation, and I'm speaking more towards New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. But if there's in other states or locations, they don't have a child study team. Sometimes it's the teacher, the actual special education teacher that is the case manager. And then the school psychologist will be the one doing majority of the testing among an OT, PT, speech. If there's anything needed in regards to an AAC device, then that might be an additional testing component that might be done. Dependent upon where you live, but there will be the case manager at the meeting. There'll be everyone who evaluated the child at the meeting. So speech, OT, PT, any other, you know, professionals that did an evaluation. in addition to an special education teacher and a general education teacher. So that round table is getting quite full at the moment. If I'm brought into a meeting, it's not uncommon that they have either the supervisor of special services, director of special services, or another administrator present. It's more to kind of protect the school and just to have another person that's higher up there at the meetings when someone from the outside is being brought in. So I always inform parents that I'm like, don't be alarmed. If you say you're bringing an advocate or a consultant with you, sometimes this will happen. And a lot of times I get emails like, oh, Erica, you were right. They were now on the meeting. They weren't on the meeting before. I'm like, it's okay. It's not, don't be intimidated by it. It's just part of the process.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Okay. And what is the outcome of these meetings? So you're coming in prepared with your papers, an advocate, if not an advocate, just prepare myself with the knowledge of what's going to be. What actually occurs in these meetings and what result are we looking for?
Yeah. So initial meetings are mainly going over testing eligibility to see if they found them eligible or not eligible. In the event there's a difference of an opinion or agreeance and the team can't come in agreeance that maybe they found them not eligible for special education services, family and their private professionals really feel they are, there's always mediation and then due process, which are the parental rights to be able to hopefully initiate those process into more of their favor, hopefully, and come to an agreement on what's in the best interest of the child. And I always say that what's in the best interest of the child. I think sometimes that gets lost, and not purposely, but I think it gets lost that there's so much emotion getting brought into evolved and then professional opinion. So that's why I said let the numbers and data speak for itself and the evidence speak for itself. So that way that emotional piece can be taken out of it as much as it can. But it's fairly hard to do when it's your child to have that piece totally eliminated and squashed. So with that being said, I think that having enough data evidence is definitely very supportive of making those determinations. But those are in the parental rights that those processes are available in the event school and parent disagree. Other ones are annual IEP meeting. A parent can call an IEP meeting at any time that they see that is necessary. I do tell parents, please don't call them every week or every month because then that's not really effective use of your parental right. But calling them like once a quarter, once a trimester, depending upon how your school does their reporting periods, I think that is more than appropriate. And also you can meet with everyone at one time. When there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, a lot of people involved in your child's education, it gets hard to coordinate all these meetings with all these different professionals. So having an allotted amount of time to meet with everyone at one time for an IEP meeting, I think is most effective. So for the annual ones, they go over the child's goals and objectives, how they achieve them, or if there's ones that they're still working on, how we're going to tweak the goal to make it more attainable, and going over any progress that has been made or lack thereof progress, and what are we going to do to address it? What programs are we going to change? What other resources can we implement? And how can we make sure that these goals are measurable and obtainable and achievable for the child? And that usually occurs at the annual. But I do always, if you notice that you have progress reports, which are kind of the report card, but for the IEP, for lack of better words, for the goals and objectives. If you notice that you're getting, oh, my child's already achieved this goal, then coordinate with your case manager, ask for an amendment to be made so that's not empty space in that child's IEP. Let's put another goal in there. Now, amendment does make paperwork. So sometimes that a parent does have to advocate and push for that change, but it is something that is possible to make sure that the child doesn't have that empty space or gap in their IEP, that if we achieved so many goals, well, then why are we not adding new ones? Why are we not increasing the contingency from prompting to independency? So let's see if we can do that sooner than later and by waiting till their annual review.
That's amazing. And I love that you could request a meeting. And I think that I love that also component that you brought where bringing everyone to the table more than once a year is important, because a lot of times we're each, as someone from the interdisciplinary team, like we each do the goals that we're successful with, and we're trying our best and we're doing our best with that child. But if another discipline is having real great success in managing behavior and a different discipline has it, and when we get to that table and we're able to, exchange ideas and discuss progress and discuss those gaps, we're able to hear from other disciplines how they're making really great progress and what is working for that child. So calling those meetings is important and is within the parents, you know, jurisdiction to do. So
yes, I think being like an educator or working with other like disciplines, such as OT, like yourself, if you're having success in one area and if you have a supportive administrator, like saying like, hey, you know what? Speech therapist is having great progress with this kid. She's seeing very limited behaviors, but I'm dealing with everything when they come to me. Maybe I can go and observe by that speech therapist, see what teaching strategies they're using, what approaches they're doing. It could be something as simple as environment or tone, and being able to have that. Now, not all administrators are built the same, but that collaboration is very important inside the school system as well, especially when you're trying to support a child and you're not having as much success as maybe another discipline area. So I think that is very, you know, good, great point, that we want to make sure that we have that collaboration happening among the team, and seeing more of the faces of the team for this child in one setting, having that opportunity to collaborate. Because sometimes that is all the time that you get to collaborate is 5 minutes before this child's IEP meeting when you're inside of a school, because you're not being able to talk to all your other team members on a daily basis. I never probably sat down when I was a teacher. I was always running around to the different areas, be like, hey, do you see this? Or hey, is this working? Or I tried this today, or they're feeling this way today. Like, it was just always a very collaborative approach, or, you know, I'm seeing that they're struggling, you know, with their uppercase letters. Do you have any strategies I can carry over quickly? And it would always be with the OT and I in the hallway, like on the run, or same thing with speech therapists, because they're on the go. You have a lot of kids on your caseload, you got to see. So it's never like a sit down meeting that you get to actually be able to sit and process. It's always on the go.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's important. It's important to just have that time to really share and finish the circle.
Yes. And I know a lot of teachers have said this too. They're like, if we can really have the family ask for it, it's a much higher probability that the school or they'll allow us to do it. Because sometimes we need the family to be like, hey, just give that a little nudge and I'm sure we can get this going for you. Because sometimes the family is the one that kind of has that power to make that decision if you have staff members that are kind of maybe butting heads with their administrators. I've had, unfortunately, a very positive experience with my administrators that I've worked with. But I've heard from friends and other professionals that it's not as such. And so they're like, I really just need the family to say something because I know if the family does, it will get done. But even though I'm here in the inside trying to do everything I can, it's not working. So really having that family connection, that collaboration, building that rapport with every family is really important, you know, to even the teacher's success in the classroom too.
Yeah, 100%. And what is another idea that I always tell parents is join a Facebook group or whatever yeah. sort of communication group is going on in your school. Because not because you know, you want to be nosy or anything, but gaining tips from other parents that have navigated the system and is like, oh, Mrs. G, stay away from her. She's really nasty. And then Mrs. H is so nice. Go her way. Like, those small tips could really help a parent in just understanding and also not feeling like shot down, you know, when we go full force ahead and we're in the wrong place and then we get shot down. It's a disheartening experience and it makes us not want to do that again in the future. But if we engage with individuals that are like, you know, on the same page as us and able to help with that topic and they actually do, then we're more likely to do that again in the future. So just doing research ahead of time and prepping ourselves ahead of time, finding out which hat each person wears is really important in the process because then it will help us as parents to, you know, continue to do that.
Yes. Yeah. I always, you know, tell my clients too, there's certain things that are more appropriate coming from a parent than it all is from your advocate and consultant. Because I have my professional lane that I'm staying in and trying to really build that connection, that the collaboration piece. But if you have something that's emotionally driven or an opinion, that's best coming from you because you can speak from your personal experience. You can speak to your why. And as long as it's done in a professional manner, and sometimes feathers get ruffled. And sometimes that's the only way to actually make a change. And, you know, I always say that sometimes those kids who don't have any behaviors are the ones who innately fall through the cracks, not because the teacher's not looking at them, but because they might have extreme behaviors or different, a lot of neurodivergent students in the classroom that their attention naturally gets turned to. So speaking up for those students who, you know, also might not have behaviors, it might just be that really good egg or, you know, oh, but why are they not doing well in reading? Or why are they not thriving in their social groups? Like, you know, being an advocate for those students as well is very important too.
100%. If you had to give parents advice on the best means of communication, the best tone, the best thought process to come in with to a meeting, what would that be?
I would always say, you know, obviously to be kind, to be professional, to be collaborative, to come off neutral in the sense where I see this at home. So this is what I'm having. List the observable behaviors. Do you see this at school? And see if there is that same between home and school. I always say communicate via email because you have that paper trail. And there's always a phone call, you know, that's warranted in those meetings and stuff because the teacher's like, it's quicker for me to give you a quick call than it is to send a lengthy email, make sure it's all, you know, all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed. So sometimes that's why that phone call has happened. But to keep those notes in regards to what that communication was with your teacher, see and say, oh, I'll thank you for the strategy. I'll try that at home. Sometimes you might not even agree with it, but even just a simple thank you for the input, I'll give it a try, does go a long way because it does show that collaboration piece. But even though if you're not like, my kid is not going to do this, and there's certain things, you know, as well too, like, you know, bringing my daughter to like doctor's appointments, they tell me to do something. I'm like, have you met my daughter? She's not going to do that. Like, you know, and I'll have to think of a different way or talk to a different professional that's like, oh, okay. Like, you know, I could try it this way. Maybe that might be more suited for her. It's all about what's works for the child. If, even if you have siblings, you know, one teacher might be more fitted for your son, but then you have your daughter going to school and be like, oh, that might be a great fit teacher. I loved her, but it's your daughter's so different. So that teacher might not be the right fit for your daughter. So I think it's also having that collaborative, everything goes down to communication and collaboration and making sure it's effective. So having those email correspondence, having those phone calls, asking for parent-teacher conferences, even when it's outside of those time frames, I think does go a long way to show what you are trying and sharing the positives. I think a lot of people think to share those negatives first or what's the problem. And it's, I don't think, done maliciously or it's done intentionally, but it's sometimes when it's always on the forefront, always prominent, that's what you're speaking to. So I think finding going or even going out of your way for the kid that there's really, really like you're really trying with this kid, but going out of your way, like, you know what? They said hi to a friend today, like trying to pull those positives. And that was something maybe they never did before. So that would be something that I would really highlight. What are some positives? And both teacher and, you know, as well as parent, giving this positive to the professional. A simple thank you does go a long way and acknowledgement of your efforts as well.
I love that. I love a lot of the points that you brought up. One being A, to like really say the positive things, because it's so important for the people that are working with your child every day to have a good feeling about your child and think of them in a positive way. And then when you have something negative to say, to really say it in like a data-driven way, like, this is the occurrence that happened. And this is what, like, I thought went wrong versus when we come in and we start with, like, accusations or, like, pinpointing where we thought it went wrong. The staff could get really defensive and then it sort of misses what you were trying to do anyway. And then it becomes, like, an emotional sort of thing instead of let's problem solve and come out with a better solution for the future.
Yeah, there's a time to use your I statements and a time that there's not to use your I statements when you're, you know, addressing certain circumstances. So, yes, I'm a very big forefront on speaking from what the actual situations were, especially when, you know, I could say that, oh, and it potentially antecedent was this when I observed, but I'm not 100% sure because I wasn't only sitting there looking to see what happened before the behavior. I can just go off of a professional opinion or judgment in that moment. From working with a particular student, and which is also a lot of families, you know, hire me as well to go in to do the observations at school. So that way they have that extra eye in there because they know the teacher can't do everything and it can't be in multiple places. So it's not so much of me observing, you know, the teacher by any means, which sometimes I think they feel that way because it's like, oh, you need an expert coming in here to go observe me. And it's not observing you, it's observing the child. And let's see, like, you might be saying or doing something, but they're so focused. And I've had this on a sound happening in the back of the classroom because another kid kept rocking back and forth their chair. And I said, every time you were speaking, they kept looking in the back. So then they're like, oh, well, I wouldn't have caught that because what are they doing? They're teaching. So they wouldn't have caught every little thing, whereas my job is to find what is, why are we causing so much distractibility? Why is our attention down in this subject matter? And why is it up in a different subject matter? So that's my, you know, job to help that process and not to, you know, do, like, again, not for an I got you moment. It's to help the child and benefit them and give them that, you know, platform to really leap forward in their goals and objectives.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Okay. Have you found this work very gratifying?
Oh, yes. I love every single family I've worked with. I have loved working with. I love getting pictures of there's, you know, we had, I had a case in South Jersey area and, you know, the mom was like, there have been, none of these children have been in inclusion ever because that wasn't the school model. When they went to specials with their self-contained class, the same seven peers that they had in their self-contained class. So now that they're going to specials and being included with their general education, you know, students, they're like, now all the families get this opportunity just because we brought in you and we really pushed for our kid. Now it's possible for all the kids. So those are really gratifying moments to really see that pivotal change on a greater scale. Or getting pictures of a kid being finally included in class. You know, I've received those, you know, as well recently. Or even when I've been pushing into the home environment and seeing something happen at school, but it's finally translating to home. It's, you know, just such a wonderful feeling. And I, you know, love all the families I work with. I always get like choked up because I'm very emotional, but it's for a positive reason because my whole thing is I have set high expectations. I never set low expectations. I always presume competence. Making dangerous assumptions is a way to not make progress. Assuming someone can't do something before being able to see what are those strengths that we can enhance those areas of weakness or areas for improvement. I think that that is really a model that, you know, needs to be replicated because a lot of kids have these strengths. Even, you know, being diagnosed with dyslexia, there's a lot of things that I can do differently because of having dyslexia, but it doesn't make it wrong. It just makes it different. But those differences allow me to do what I do and allows me to connect with my students in a different manner because I've been there. And I understand how you're feeling. I understand the pressures. I understand why we're getting emotional during a subject because I was you. I get it. Or being able to tell a parent, they're going to be fine. They're going to achieve their goals. They're going to be successful in what they can do. But what your biggest role is to listen to your child, communicate with them, and support them. Because they're going to be getting the haters already, but they need somewhere that's grounding to them that knows that I can do this and I can achieve everything. And, you know, even being successful and having 4.0s all throughout, you know, college and grad school, I still had professors that'd be like, you're just too smart. Don't tell anyone you have dyslexia because you won't get it. And they were concerned for me because they're like, you're just too smart. And just to have that connotation from professors in education that I was like, oh, well, I really, you know, shouldn't say anything because I, you know, I can do this job. I passed the Praxis the first time. Like you know, I do know how to, but like even till, you know, till this day, sometimes those insecurities pop up, but I always have my family that grounds me and has that, always believes in me, even in those moments that might get tough. So I just want that for all students to have that person or people in their surrounding that can lift them up, especially when times get hard.
Wow. Wow. That's, I love that you have that personal view and understanding and empathy for the students that you work with. If you could take us on a small journey of your dyslexia, tell us a little bit about when you recognized or your parents recognized that you had it and what sort of, what does dyslexia mean and what sort of interventions and supports really helped you through it?
Yes. So after my mom, you know, she was like, you know, I can give Erica a book about dinosaurs, but she'll tell me that it's about, I don't know, baking. Something that was, you know, but I was able to read or, you know, decode words, you know, relevantly well or be able to memorize well. So whenever I heard something, I was able to memorize it and be able to output it. I still to this day, you know, everyone's like, your memory is pretty scary because it just is a skill set. I knew, you know, that me listening to something, me hearing something, me being able to go to colleges that were in person versus doing a virtual program was going to be what was best for me, because I needed that in-person lecture because I'm an auditory learner. I absorb, I hear, I remember, versus that comprehension piece of having a textbook, being able to read and then output the information wasn't a strength of mine. So they did Orton Gillingham. I did tutoring probably from third grade all the way through eighth grade. Every single weekend, I went to an Orton Gillingham specialist that solely worked on all of the phonemic awareness abilities in, you know, the reading language, the literacy, English language for reading. And I will say a lot of people are like, why are you don't do OG now? I say I have maybe a little touch of PTSD from doing it, because it was so ingrained in you, the system, and it clearly worked. And I'm a firm believer in it. But even like I can like remember sitting there with my tutor as well, like hearing her isolate the sounds and then having me like repeat it back to her and decode the word by, you know, itself. And I'll sit there because I can hear it. I remember feeling it like in my head, but the way it came out was just not accurate the whole time. So I can even like see that whole process of me, and then that would build frustration. And then I would get upset with myself, you know, during the, you know, the session. So anytime, you know, it was tough. And then as I got older, I always had tutors in content areas. So if we had physics, then I went to, well, Borders was a thing at the time. So like, you know, bookstore, and, you know, physics teacher would come in, I would sit down and do my tutoring based on content area. And even if I felt strong in a certain content area, I think it just was also a confidence builder for me. That I knew the content or could study before a test. So those were a lot of things. Tutoring was, you know, huge for me, you know, throughout school. I had a 504, so I didn't have an IEP. When I was evaluated by the educational psychologist, you know, my family went to, she said, Erica just needs these accommodations to be successful. So having the extended time, having larger font print, being able to, you know, have a more direct instruction was what was appropriate for me throughout my career to do that. But some teachers made it hard for me to have extra time. And I can still remember going home and saying, like, I didn't get extra time on my science test today. So I told them and they said, no, that was it. That was all the time I had. Class ran out. So that's when my parents would get involved and then advocate for me going to the school. But I always was at my 504 meetings since I was in the sixth grade. My parents found that it was very important for me to go and know that we're all on one team and make sure I was aware of what my rights were as well. So I really, I'm grateful for those opportunities because I was an advocate for myself at a young age and was aware of what was going on and what I had rights to or an entitled to ask for.
Wow. And as a child, now an adult, would you do the same thing for your own child as far as including them in their planning and explaining to them what's happening to them?
Yes, I absolutely would without a hesitation. And it also depends on your child and also their cognitive abilities. What is the goal from it? So, you know, if my child were to have dyslexia as well, and I would be able to bring them into the meetings and say, this is what's going on. This is what we're talking about. Do you have any questions for your teachers? Do you have anything? And obviously prep them beforehand for it. But I think having them involved and understanding that this is a process and what you have the rights to and are entitled to ask for is very important. And in addition, I think it also builds a lot of confidence as well that, you know, I didn't have to begin with, because I didn't know like that. I thought always like, oh, I'm not as smart as everyone else, or that was why. But knowing that I actually had something that also I had to learn differently. My mom always just described it as a detour cone. You just have to learn to get around it in different ways. And that visual always stuck with me, you know, so that way I knew it wasn't that I was less than, I knew it was different and I can still achieve the same goals, if not even more. So that was always very, you know, important to me. And even going to these meetings, I think it learns those executive functioning skills that I'm working with high school students on now. It's important to teach at a young age. It's all very teachable. How do we manage our time? How do we, you know, study for a test? How do we, you know, do certain things to make us successful? I think those are all explicitly taught skills that somehow got lost in the shuffle over the pendulum shift of different things, you know, throughout time.
Right, right. Life skills in a way are more important, and we use them daily versus our academic skills, and really stopping and teaching the children those skills of advocacy for themselves and the social interaction, and those skills are really important. And like you said, sometimes we need to break them down and explain them to children, because they don't just get that on their own. And it's, as parents, it's our job, as teachers, it's our jobs to really empower the children that way.
Yeah, I think a lot of decisions are made without asking the child. I think there are certain times when it's appropriate and certain times when it's, you know, not appropriate, depending, again, it's everything is individual to the child. But if there's a behavior, if there's something going on, why not ask them, why do we think we did that today? What was going on in your head? How are we feeling? And seeing if they can articulate what's going on, how they're feeling, or this is a plan we're going to try. Do you have any thoughts about it? And seeing what their opinion is about it, including them in part of the process. I really feel that that allowed me to be very successful in my teaching, you know, journey, is that I allowed students' voices to be heard and be part of the journey, and not just saying, this is what we're doing. And I think that was, you know, giving them a voice, allowing them to build trust and rapport. Is something that I always did before academics. I developed the whole child and not just one part of just the education. And that's what I do in my advocacy and consulting. I'm a very good listener. So I love listening to families and their students. So I want to give them all the time that they need to really explain what's happening and what's going on. Because there are a lot of multi-layers and facets to where our child is now. So for me, I'm part of the whole journey. I'm not just there when there's a problem.
Yeah. And I love that listening component, because sometimes, like, except I've told my husband, now you need to just sit and listen, because as we talk and we sort of like unpack what's happening and say the details of the story, we start to process in our own brains what's happening. And like you said, you're a great listener, and it's really important for children to have that great listener in their lives and parents to have that great listener in their lives. And if they don't, you got to find that person, because, you know, our thoughts are like sort of tangled up there, and they're great thoughts, and they're tangled up there, and they're sitting there, and we need to sometimes unpack them and untangle them and really pull out, you know, that message or that point or that component that we're looking for in solving issues and understanding a problem.
Yes. That's why I always tell any family, you know, with a child, not just with autism, but I say with autism because it's a huge spectrum. So we also have that range of that communication component too. And having maintained home communication in that child's IEP is so essential. Even if you have the world's best teacher that is doing it innately, it's not legally binding unless it's in that IEP. So I just want to make sure that everything that's being done and all that great teaching practices, that if it's not being carried over to the following year to a different teacher, at least we have the documents to show that this is what worked, this is why it's effective, and this is why we're asking for it to be formally listed. So that home communication is wonderful, especially when I have clients that say, I'm arguing with the school just to get my child's AAC device to come home with them. So I say, when you go to the next meeting, ask them the question, would you like to stop talking when you leave work and can't communicate at home with your family? Because that's what you're asking my child to do. So putting that into perspective and respectfully, but that's where I think having that mindset and putting that onus back on the school and accountability is also where it's essential, because it does hopefully will open their eyes and be like, no, we really need to solve this problem. Whether it be something as simple as, I lost the paperwork that you turned it in. So that's why you're not getting it. It's not a library book. It's someone's form of communication. So I think that it's really important to stay on top of it and know what's happening, you know, at school.
Amazing. Erica, you have been so informative to our audience today. I think many of our listeners will really tap into these ideas when moving forward with the education system. Where can people find you if they're looking to hear more about what you do?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's VAEL Advocacy and Consulting.com. VAEL is V as in Victor, IEL, Advocacy and Consulting.com. They can find me there. They could book a session, you know, with me. I offer a free consultation for, you know, all families. We see if we're a good fit. And if you're looking for something in particular, if I'm not that good fit, I'm always happy to also do referrals to others that I know about, or be able to provide those resources. That's also part of my business, is that you can hire me just to do that and build that list for you, do all that legwork, and that's part of that consulting piece. So yeah, I hope I can help any more families to be informed of what their rights are and help benefit their child's lives.
Amazing. Thank you, Erica, for coming on today and sharing all your wonderful knowledge with us.
Aw, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.